And good morning. I'm Ewan Kerr, in for Tom Webber. First up this hour, sexual harassment at the Minnesota State Capitol. Criminal justice lobbyist Sarah Walker went public earlier this month with allegations of persistent sexual harassment by Republican State Representative Tony Cornish. Cornish resigned from the legislature last week as part of an agreement worked out with lawyers for the two parties. Yesterday, Sarah Walker sat down with NPR's Brian Bax for her first on-the-record interview since she went public with her accusations. They were joined later by her husband, Brock Hunter, who also works at the Capitol. We're going to listen now to that conversation. Brian began by asking Walker what the last couple of weeks have been like.
It's definitely been a hard few weeks, but I don't regret making the decision. I think that the issues of sexual harassment at state capitals across the country have been just under the surface for many, many years. And it's something that I've talked about privately with colleagues and with my husband for many years. And I just think that this moment and culture and time was the time to come forward.
Is this a story that you thought about telling publicly before?
For many years, I had considered possible ways to address it. But as I think we've heard a lot about, there aren't a lot of avenues at the Capitol for specifically lobbyists to come forward and tell their stories. You really risk hurting you, or at least you fear hurting your career in a pretty damaging, significant way by coming forward. Lobbyists have to build relationships with lawmakers in order to have their bills heard. And I just want to put in perspective, some of the issues that lobbyists work on are issues that are deeply important to them and they've worked on for decades. And so you feel like you're in a you have to make a decision between what you're working on and coming forward.
So what about the time that we're in gave you that motivation or that comfort in going public?
Well, again, I will say this, that I had actually been speaking with my husband about doing something about this for over a year. And then when the whole Me Too phenomena began happening, I was feeling more and more like the time was now to find an avenue to address it. I didn't anticipate it happening in the way that it unfolded, but I think the other thing that made me decide to come forward is that when the accusations about Senator Schoen happened, there was just such a swift response from both sides of the aisle calling for his resignation. So I think that perhaps naively, I hoped that if I had come forward that, or when I came forward, that there would be a similar response.
And Senator Schoen, of course, is the Democratic senator who was accused of doing things when he was in the House, and he's since announced that he's going to resign in mid-December. But let's back up for a bit. How long have you been lobbying at the Capitol and what types of issues do you work on?
Yeah, I've been lobbying at the Capitol for about a decade, actually. Not always as a full-time contract lobbyist, but for years before I became a professional lobbyist, I was working on issues specifically around criminal justice from a nonprofit platform.
And I imagine that's probably how you first crossed paths with Tony Cornish, the representative who chaired the House Public Safety Committee.
Yes, that is how. And I mean, I think many people also will know that there's been a sea change in how we view criminal justice, that it went from sort of tough on crime and soft on crime to thinking about it and smart on crime. But a lot of that required really working hard and working in a bipartisan way. And so even when Democrats were in power and Tony Cornish didn't have the gavel, I was still told by my colleagues that I had to pass bipartisan bills. So there was no way around having to work with Tony Cornish, regardless of who was in power in the House.
And did the type of behavior that alarmed you happen right away with Tony Cornish?
It happened almost immediately, yes, from my very first meeting. And it was unrelenting and never ending until now.
Like he would make comments to you? He would send you messages? What types of things would he do that kind of got you on your heels?
I mean, speaking in very forward sexual language and, you know, continuously propositioning, asking to go on dates. I mean, it really ran the whole gamut, but I would say that it was consistent and persistent throughout my time.
And at worst, what was going on?
I mean, I think the worst case that's already been reported was, you know, him actually referring to his male genitalia and asking me not to leave his office. And I do remember on that specific day, I almost decided to leave lobbying permanently. But I went home and I left work early that day, actually. And I went home and, you know, decided that I cared more about the issues that I was working on and giving some of the people in the criminal justice system without a voice. I cared more about making progress in that area than what I felt like was a personal affront to me.
And did you keep it to yourself inside you, or did you confide in people and kind of talk about that a little bit?
Oh, I absolutely confided in people. I think, I spoke to many of my close female lobbyist friends, other friends outside of the political world. Lobbyists, especially female lobbyists, we have a pretty tight circle of women, and we do talk about these things. And the problem at the Minnesota State Capitol related to sexual harassment is a cultural problem. I mean, as now has been reported, that even their sexual harassment policy hadn't been updated for 25 years. I mean, the Capitol is really decades behind where nonprofits and corporate people are in terms of policies and practices. I think that when I would confide in people, I think they were all extremely sympathetic, but they also knew the difficulty and the limited options in coming forward.
Did you give serious consideration to going to House leadership, you know, raising the complaint in some other way, or just going public with it?
I hadn't considered going public or going to House leadership as a real option. And I think, like many women, first of all, you fear not being able to work in your chosen profession, which, you know, I love and value being able to do. Two, you do fear retaliation, subtle and not subtle retaliation. And I think finally, there was no clear process to actually make a complaint. So the only option was to go public. And, I think many women are the primary breadwinners in their homes. You know, they're single moms working as lobbyists as capitals. They have a variety of reasons and issues why they might not be able to make the same decision to come forward.
So a little more than 2 weeks ago, you decided that you just wouldn't let it go anymore. And at the time, you first spoke confidentially with a couple of reporters, including myself. Did that bring you a sense of relief, or did it just raise your anxiety?
I think there was a brief moment where I had some sense of relief because this has been weighing on me for many years. But I will say the next 2 weeks were filled with a lot of anxiety just based on the unpredictability. It didn't take but a few minutes after this first story was reported in the Star Tribune for people, even though I was anonymous, I would say media, lawmakers, lobbyists, people at the Capitol to start texting me, identifying me. So it was extremely anxiety producing. And the other thing is though, I did have a conversation with my husband prior to this and made it very clear that this could have huge implications. And a lot of women don't have the option of relying on their husband to support them if something was to go really wrong. But once I made that decision, I knew I was going to go in for the long haul and want to see this through to make some institutional changes.
What else was the response like behind the scenes? Both good and bad.
I will tell you honestly that I haven't received a single bad response, which I have actually been a little surprised by in this age of social media. But I was actually heartened by the number of people from both sides of the aisle, staff, people from other parts of my professional life reaching out. And I really felt overwhelmingly supported by my colleagues. And I think one of the most meaningful things was I saw at some point that a group of female lobbyists organized a sort of social media campaign where they were saying that they believed me. And I think it reassured me and it helped me stay the course and made me realize that I'd made the right decision.
You said that in the past, retaliation was a concern of yours. Did anyone telegraph to you that in this case that you could face consequences for being out there?
I have not received any sense that there is going to be retaliation. I think it's who knows what will happen, but I think that the larger cultural moment is also making people realize that this is an endemic problem. And the other thing is, I think most lawmakers, the vast majority of lawmakers, are good people who aren't engaging in this behavior. And I think that they agree that when this behavior occurs, it hurts the entire institution.
And amid these moments of anxiety that you had, when did you get the sense that this would in fact end with Representative Cornish leaving the legislature?
Well, I have to say that I was confident that he would end up leaving the legislature almost as soon as there was even the call for an independent investigation. I believe, and that his behavior was widespread and well-known, and that would have been hard for him to survive such an independent investigation. But I think the question for me was, how quickly was the process going to play out? An independent investigation could have taken up to a year and would have involved multiple parties and many people coming forward. And I think that that would have been a much longer, more painful process for me and the institution.
Had you allowed yourself to think about kind of operating through another session where he was in charge of a committee where a lot of your work goes through?
Oh, I absolutely had made that consideration. I fundamentally believed that my longstanding relationships and expertise in the subject matter would have carried me through that time period. Of course, I would not be something I was looking forward to, but I feel like I would have been able to manage.
And am I correct that you didn't receive a dime of personal compensation from this?
No, and it's so strange to me because I honestly, it had never occurred to me, not even for one second, to request compensation. It wasn't until I heard or read, which you should never do, read comments in the Star Tribune, and saw people making a sort of accusation that this was just to get money. And it had not even ever occurred to me, and it certainly it was nothing I ever even considered. I do want to say, though, while I never considered that, I'm fortunate to be in a position where I'm able to keep my job and have a husband. I think other women don't always have that same option. And I don't want to diminish the fact that at times civil actions and requests for compensation are sometimes, unfortunately, the only way to hold serious perpetrators accountable.
But why wasn't that important to you?
First of all, I think I have a comfortable life. I'm not looking for money. But second, my main goal was to seek institutional change and to make sure that other women didn't have to go through what I went through. And compensation for me personally just would not have accomplished that. If it had gone on a much longer period of time and I had somehow changed my mind, I would have made a conscious decision to donate that to some other group if I was to receive compensation. But it never occurred to me, nothing that I wanted. And I just want to have dignity in the workplace.
This is NPR News. If you're just tuning in, we're listening to Sarah Walker, a lobbyist at the state capitol, talking about her allegations of sexual harassment against State Representative Tony Cornish. Walker and her husband, Brock Hunter, sat down with NPR's Brian Baxt.
After Representative Cornish gave word he would go, you put out a statement that both identified you as one of the people who had alleged harassment by him and made an appeal for that culture that you've talked about to be reined in. Talk to me first about why, after all that, you wanted your name out there.
So I think the first reason I decided to go public was because the Capitol is the best analogy. It's sort of like a high school. It's a very intimate place. Immediately, as soon as the first story broke, the vast majority of people at the Capitol had already been able to identify me through process of elimination. And so for me, it was more comfortable at this point to come forward and not have to deal with this sort of speculation or questioning and just make it one broad statement. But I think the other reason that I thought was important was because when the initial lawmakers came forward about Senator Schoen and Representative Cornish, I think it was really important to draw a distinction between the role of lawmakers and the role of lobbyists at the Capitol. And unfortunately, until I came forward, there really wasn't conversation going on about how lobbyists are treated and the extreme power dynamics that female lawmakers aren't subject to in the same way that lobbyists are. And also female lobbyists don't also have any sort of form of formal recourse.
And you said in that statement that you hoped you could, quote, help others make the tough decisions to speak out regarding their own stories. Do you think they will?
I think that if other women see that you can make a public complaint or a private complaint and actually see someone be held accountable and also not face retaliation, I think that it will help other women make that decision to speak out. I also think that many other women did speak out. I know you reported on a story where you spoke to 25 other women and lawmakers. I don't know who most of those people are. I can make guesses about them. But other women do want to have their voices heard. And I also think that the fact that female lobbyists really did rally around me and send me words of support, start a social media campaign, and all that to me is a fundamental indication that there is an institutional problem and the institutional constraints on lobbyists and making these complaints needs to have a voice.
So you suspect that there are other bad actors up there that just so far have escaped public attention?
Yes, I think there are other bad actors. I don't think that Senator Schoen and Representative Cornish are the only two people to engage in sexually harassing behavior.
Is it a lot of people?
I think, you know, I am more interested in telling my own personal story, and I don't really want to speculate on what other women have been through, but I'm confident that there's more people who have experienced sexual harassment.
Throughout this kind of public moment of examining sexual harassment, we've seen kind of a varying degree of behavior women have been talking about, you know, that goes beyond business as usual to, you know, bantering or joking or, you know, worse. How should people know when it crosses the line?
You know, I think one of the best rules of thumb is, would you say what you were saying in front of your spouse or in front of your colleagues? Very often, and certainly in my case, a lot of it happened in private. And I think if you wouldn't say that in front of your colleagues or in front of your constituents, you probably shouldn't be saying it to another lobbyist or lawmaker.
And do you believe that resignations are the proper response to credible accusations, or is there another form of justice or accountability that you feel is could be appropriate in these cases?
Well, as a longtime criminal justice reformer, I'm a big believer in due process, actually. And so while I think in these cases resignation was appropriate, I would say that the reason why we ended up with having to call for resignations is because there was no process created that allowed for due process, either for a victim or the person accused. And I think that is a fundamental problem. And I would also say that if there was a process in place to make these complaints and address them, a lot of this might not have ever gotten to the point where people had to resign.
And you mentioned in your statement, your husband, and he's here with us. Do you mind if I ask him a little bit about kind of you had said, Brock, that or Sarah said that you guys had discussed this at home. You were there supporting her in private. What was your thinking about whether she should have kind of gone public when she first brought it to you a couple of years ago?
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, this has been a constant topic of conversation throughout our relationship. Sarah let me know right away when we got together that this was something she's experiencing on a day-to-day basis at the Capitol, which was difficult for me because my first initial instinct was to want to do something about it and to step in some way. But given the circumstances, that was really just as difficult or impossible as it would be for her to step forward at that point. For me to say anything or do anything would jeopardize her career and all of the issues that she has spent years and years working on. And so it was just a difficult realization that it was something that I had to step back and rely on her to deal with as she saw fit. And a couple of weeks ago, when she told me that she was deciding to come forward, I had a moment of like, okay, here we go. But I never doubted her in that regard, and I never doubted that it was the right thing to do. And I think the timing of it was spot on.
Was there any reluctance on your part to your wife being the public face of this fight against sexual harassment?
No. My wife is the public face of many important battles that need to be fought, and this is just another one. And I was proud of her from the moment she stepped forward and supported her throughout the process. It was, to say it was stressful the last couple of weeks would be an understatement. She's been incredibly strong throughout this whole process, and I guess the hardest part was just not knowing how long it was going to go on and whether this independent investigation that the House had commissioned was going to drag on for a year or more. I had concerns of just how she was going to hold up to that long-term stress, and particularly coming back to the Capitol and going back to work in session with this investigation going on. There was just a lot of unknowns as to how that was all going to go. So the fact that it came to an end point as quickly as it did, I think, was very welcome.
If I'm not mistaken, you have a legal background and, in fact, do do some work up at the Capitol as well, in a similar space.
Yes.
Were there times when you were sitting in that committee room when you knew what he was alleged to have done to her that you just wanted to get up and confront him?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And yeah, I am a criminal defense lawyer, and I do a lot of work in criminal justice reform as well. In fact, that's how Sarah and I first met. And so I know Tony Cornish and all the other players at the Capitol, and was very intimately familiar with the dynamics at play and what she was going through. And yes, I've been in hearings where she was in the room as well as Mr. Cornish, and it was something very, very much at the front of my mind.
And you mentioned, of course, you're a criminal defense attorney, so due process is extremely important to you and your clients, innocent until proven guilty. Kind of where should that come in this sexual harassment conversation? Because it seems like there has been almost a trial by public opinion rather than kind of the normal course of things here.
That's absolutely right. I guess in this particular case of Tony Cornish, I think his bad conduct at the legislature is something that was never in doubt, at least in my mind. It's something that has been just pervasive and widespread, and I think everyone at the Capitol was aware of it. In his particular case, I don't think that the lack of due process was a huge issue there. And in fact, the investigative work of NPR, I thought, was in itself a significant due process. 25 different people that you interviewed over the course of preparing your story last week was in and of itself an investigation like the House, I think, was just gearing up to do. And the number of people who came forward with information about Mr. Cornish, I think, eliminated any doubt. And I would expect most, if not all, people's minds that he was guilty of the conduct that Sarah and others had alleged against him. But I do think that the issue of due process as we go forward is going to be a big deal, because there are people being accused where it is not as clear whether they're guilty of sexual harassment and whether or not there are political motives behind the accusations being made. And I do think that it's something that we do need to pay attention to going forward and make sure that people aren't losing their careers and reputations over an accusation that doesn't have a lot of substance to it and may be motivated by other factors.
You know, I'm sure in the days after you went public and even under the anonymous terms and then later with your name attached, you've had countless conversations with women whose stories sound a lot like yours. What needs to happen for them to be comfortable telling their stories and confronting their harassers?
If I was the House and Senate, I would ask for an independent investigation about the entire state of sexual harassment at the Capitol, and not necessarily to call individuals out, but to actually make recommendations about how to improve the process. One of the things that I am absolutely certain of is you have to have an independent third party that is not, so you don't have to make a complaint to the speaker or majority leader directly, but you should have a place where you can come and talk to someone about what you've experienced. You don't have to go public unless you want to. But right now, it appears that really the only process is making a public ethics complaint or, you know, calling for one or doing what I've done, which is come out publicly. And that is a huge burden to carry and a gigantic weight.
What do you think it's going to be like when you step foot back in the Capitol for kind of next year's session, people knowing that your story, among others, was imperative in bringing down this very powerful figure there?
Well, honestly, I'm hoping that it won't be much different than normal, except I'm actually really positive. And if anything, the last week or two has shown me or increased my belief in the inherent goodness in people. I've been overwhelmed by the responses. And the other thing is, you know, there's already hearings going on at the Capitol. So I will be back at the Capitol this week and doing my work. And I'm anticipating that nothing is going to change in terms of my job at this moment.
You're hoping.
I am hoping.
That was criminal justice lobbyist Sarah Walker and her husband Brock Hunter talking with NPR's Brian Baxt. Walker went public earlier this month with allegations of sexual harassment by Republican State Representative Tony Cornish. Cornish resigned from the legislature last week. U.S. Senator Al Franken has also been accused of sexual misconduct. He talked yesterday with NPR's Kathy Werzer. You can find that conversation on our website, nprnews.org.